From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. A couple of weeks ago, watching the political media chase their tails, we asked linguist George Lakoff for guidance on how to report on the erroneous emissions, whether by Twitter or mouth, of Donald J. Trump. In his first week in office, the nation's capital shook under a fusillade of flim-flam. So we tried out Lakoff's prescriptions on one recent presidential tweet. Lakoff says you cover his tweets by first not covering his tweet.
You begin by telling the truth and giving the evidence for that truth.
So here's the truth. This past November, the United States held a free and fair election in which Donald Trump lost the popular vote by nearly 2.9 million votes, but won the Electoral College by 74 votes, thereby winning the presidency.
Then mention his tweet, point out that that contradicts the truth.
Wednesday's tweet.
I will be asking for a major investigation into voter fraud, including those registered to vote in two states, those who are illegal, and even those registered to vote who are dead, and many for a long time. Depending on results, we will strengthen up voting procedures.
The truth is that voter fraud is virtually non-existent. In one study, law professor Justin Levitt found 31 credible incidents out of 1 billion ballots cast. Even members of the GOP agree, including House Speaker Paul Ryan.
I've seen no evidence to that effect, and I've made that very, very clear.
And Trump's own campaign has argued that, quote, all available evidence suggests that the 2016 general election was not tainted by fraud or mistake. So, George, what do we do now?
Talk about what kind of tweet this is. You have to understand what the framing is, and what the framing is he's trying to avoid.
Trump's Twitter call to investigate millions of allegedly fraudulent votes is what Lakoff calls a tweet of preemptive framing.
The idea of preemptive framing is to frame an issue before other people get a chance to put the idea out there first.
If Trump reframes his loss of the popular vote as tainted, he induces us to discuss it through that lens. It's also a tweet of diversion, bending the media's focus to the investigation and away from that irksome popular vote, which Trump views as a challenge to his mandate. And this tweet also fits a third category in Lakoff's tweet taxonomy, the trial balloon.
He's going to see how people react to this, and then he'll know what to do in the future.
Does he have popular support for a wholesale investigation into voter fraud? Run it up the flagpole and see who salutes. So what should we do when Trump issues a tweet to divert us from real issues?
Keep going back to substance and the truth.
Obviously, there are many, many, many substantial things that happened this week. President Trump kicked off his term with a flurry of executive action.
President Trump has signed an executive order pulling the U.S. out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal.
The president re-implemented an order banning American tax money from funding abortions in other countries. It's known as the Mexico City policy.
President Trump also signed a series of new executive orders earlier today, including a pair to advance the Keystone XL and Dakota Access oil pipelines.
To name just a few. He's also lost the entire senior administrative team of the State Department, signed an order that could weaken the Affordable Care Act, met with UK Prime Minister Theresa May, and kept James Comey on as head of the FBI. Oh boy, not done yet.
President Trump has signed an order to build a wall on the U.S. border with Mexico, one of his main campaign promises.
The order also curtails federal funding for sanctuary cities, hires 5,000 more Border Patrol agents, and ends the Obama-era practice of catch and release.
And then there was this.
Yesterday, the Trump administration instituted a media blackout at the EPA. It banned agency employees from giving social media updates or speaking with reporters. And it barred staff from awarding any new contracts or grants.
The EPA media blackout came on the heels of another disquieting move, calling for the National Park Service to silence its Twitter accounts. Most parks fell into line, but not all.
Badlands National Park was bad to the bone in defiance of Trump. The South Dakota Park's Twitter account fired off a tweet storm of climate science data. It was retweeted tens of thousands of times before being deleted.
It seems other Park Service staffers defied the administration's orders by spontaneously producing alternative, unregulated social media accounts.
The first was a Twitter account called Alt-US Nat Park Service. It was allegedly run by Park Service employees and quickly started sending out climate change facts and taunting the new president, saying, "You can take our official Twitter, but you'll never take our free time."
As Trump bulldozes forward, everyone is figuring out how to behave, including, of course, the press. So let's follow Bob on his field trip to the White House briefing room.
Except for the demolition of the inaugural reviewing stand on Pennsylvania Avenue, at first glance, everything here at the White House seems pretty much status quo. The line of TV production cabanas by the driveway, the pitter-patter of little features underway in the West Wing's cramped warren of press cubicles, and the routine rundown of the president's activities.
Hey, guys, good afternoon. Yesterday, the president brought leaders of both parties together to discuss his next nomination of the Supreme
Court. In reality, though, nothing this week was as it used to be. But to understand how and why, we must briefly review last Saturday at the CIA, the first official appearance of President Donald Trump. Standing in front of the hallowed Wall of Stars Memorial for personnel killed in the line of duty, Trump promptly insulted his audience's intelligence by denying that a week earlier he'd literally insulted their intelligence, belittling their analysis of Russian hacking and comparing them to Nazis. But no, he told Saturday's crowd, that was all the media's invention.
As you know, I have a running war with the media. They are among the most dishonest human beings on earth. And they sort of made it sound like I had a feud with the intelligence community. And I
just It was brilliant. We know this because that's what Trump later informed ABC's David Muir.
That speech was a home run.
That's in the air to center. Back at the Wall
of Stars.
Is gone! What a start!
Yeah, what a start. Trump got savaged by pundits left and right for using the memorial wall as a backdrop for pettiness and lies. And that incident was the backdrop later Saturday for the first White House briefing room appearance of Press Secretary Sean Spicer, who offered a slew of false statistics about the previous day's inauguration crowd, berated the press for disparaging the president, and before stalking out, issued a vague threat.
There's been a lot of talk in the media about the responsibility to hold Donald Trump accountable. And I'm here to tell you that it goes two ways. We're going to hold the press accountable as well.
The next day, presidential counselor Kellyanne Conway explained Spicer's phony claims as alternative facts, setting the stage for the alternate reality that White House coverage this week quickly became. When the press corps showed up Monday for its first official work week, it was under attack, under threat, and at pains to verify fundamental administration statements from crowd counts to imaginary voter fraud and maybe even good morning.
The briefings have taken on a different tenor.
Jordan Fabian, who covers the new administration for The Hill.
We've had to, I think, take a more adversarial stance against some of the dubious claims that have been put out there by the president and by the press secretary. I think all of us will be doing some extra checking.
I don't need to tell the country that it's learned a new bit of terminology, alternate facts.
Major Garrett of CBS News.
Those are all sweeping differences in the way this administration communicates and seeks to describe that which it is communicating, whether there's any fact basis behind it or not. This administration is comfortable on its current terrain. The great question politically and journalistically for our country is, can it remain so?
As that question is being answered, one obvious new wrinkle is who gets to do the asking. Decades of tradition have had the Associated Press getting the first question, followed by the TV networks and so on. Press Secretary Spicer has discarded that practice in favor of friendly conservative stalwarts and the farthest fringes of the right-wing media universe.
With that, I look forward to taking your questions. Daniel Halper, New York Post. Questions, Dave Boyer, Washington Times. Paul Bedard, in the best interest, John Gizzi.
Those last two from the Washington Examiner and Newsmax, which, just check it out online. And maybe next to show up will be one of the president's favorite media voices, the conspiracy peddler Alex Jones, he who claims, among other paranoiac perversities, that the Sandy Hook massacre was a hoax. Jones says there's a seat in the room awaiting him, if his InfoWars listeners would just keep, you know, sending money.
Here's the deal. I know I can get White House credentials. I've already been offered them. We're going to get them. But I just got to spend the money to send somebody there. I want to make sure it's even worth it.
The good news, and possibly exceptionally good news, is that such access has grown not just for the great right-wing media conspiracy, but for the press corps as a whole. Major Garrett.
Donald Trump likes to appear before reporters, so we've had really solid access to seeing him, hearing him talk about what he's doing, why he thinks it's important. We've also had, from a television perspective, a lot more B-roll of the people he's meeting with than we ever did under the Obama administration, business executives milling around the Roosevelt Room. We're listening to their conversations as they talk, as they see the president come in.
As we reported during that administration, access to President Obama himself was reduced to the vanishing point. At photo ops, says Jordan Fabian of The Hill, Obama's staff would literally shoo reporters away. So far under Trump, by contrast.
We've seen the president interact candidly with members of Congress, with business leaders, with union leaders. And we've gotten him to make news on things like the Supreme Court picks because we had the opportunity to be in the room and ask him questions. So it's not bad all across the board.
Of course, getting a president to say words out loud is not the same thing as getting honest, responsive answers. When access becomes a commodity, history shows, journalism tends to lose in the transaction, even if just by serving as unwitting players in presidential theater. One novel aspect of the first week's labors was a sense of cause and effect. Because Trump so obsessively follows TV coverage, whether a bilious comment from Fox's Bill O'Reilly or a press briefing question to Spicer, policy announcements have materialized in an instant. CBS correspondent Margaret Brennan.
Yesterday, I asked Sean Spicer if there was going to be an investigation of what the president said was widespread voter fraud when it came to the popular vote. At the time, he dismissed it. A few questions later, he said maybe the White House would do it. And then overnight, the president of the United States tweeted that he's actually ordering one.
Far-reaching decisions appeared to be prompted by what the president happens to catch on TV, what Kellyanne Conway might call an alternative policy task force. But don't mistake that mechanism for respect. On Thursday, presidential strategist and alt-right icon Steve Bannon derided the mainstream media for, quote, zero integrity, zero intelligence, and no hard work. During my White House visit, I asked Reuters' Jeff Mason, president of the White House Correspondents Association, about pushing back at such assaults on the very legitimacy of the free press.
Okay, let's go back to Saturday. Sean comes out, yells at everybody. There's a veiled threat in there. At least I heard one about being held accountable.
I was very surprised on Saturday by how Sean handled that statement. But I'm encouraged to see that on Monday his tone was a lot different and that he took questions, which he did not do on Saturday. We would certainly encourage taking questions from reporters whenever possible, and certainly when you're going to make a statement that is critical of the press.
And this notion that you will be held accountable, do you have any idea what he had in mind and, you know, what leverage he might have over the press?
I don't. You'd have to speak to him about that. I can't account for what he's talking about there.
I mean, have you asked him about it? Have you got an inquiry in?
I have not.
One way of saying that is that Mason is just plowing forward, being professional and not getting sucked into the drama of Trumpian invective. Another way of looking at it is, dude, when exactly with the First Amendment under siege do you press the freaking panic button, if only for the sake of the public we serve? I asked Jordan Fabian what happens when our audiences can't believe White House news, not because we can't be trusted, but because what we dutifully, professionally, dispassionately report itself is not to be trusted.
Well, it's certainly a challenge. I think we've seen what's happened with the voter fraud issue, with the crowd size issue. It'll be interesting to see what happens when there's, you know, God forbid we face a crisis as a country, you know, he has to talk about casualty counts in an overseas attack or, God forbid, an attack on the United States, you know, natural disasters, things like that, where government information is paramount. So I think when that happens, we'll see what happens.
Yes, we will see, if we're not all in some accountability black site when it happens.
Coming up, the White House has thrown out the playbook, so why should the press corps play by the rules?
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Writing on his blog, PressThink.org, New York University journalism professor Jay Rosen noted that after last weekend's spectacular display by Press Secretary Sean Spicer, the case for sending interns to the White House briefing room is stronger than ever. He said there are no good words to describe that event. We can't call it an announcement because no new policy was revealed. It was not a conference because Spicer didn't take a single question. To the untrained eye, it was merely a tantrum over the press's coverage of President Trump's inauguration. So what do we call this? Rosen says it's a coded, quote, relationship message delivery vehicle for Trump's staff, the press, and the public. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Brooke.
So what message did Spicer's tirade send to Trump's staff?
You're going to be expected to lie for your boss.
And then to the press, the message that the press will be regarded as hate objects.
Yeah. The press is a kind of a prop playing a part in a theatrical set piece in which the administration launches resentment bombs and assembled journalists kind of behave to type in that they cry about it later on. The message was, we can do this to you, and what are you going to do about it?
And we'll get to what you suggest they do about it in a moment. First, let's talk about that third group of people Spicer was messaging, the viewer at home, which you divide into three distinct groups.
First, for the Trump supporters, one of the messages was that you are going to get something you want, which is, we're going to put down the press corps, put them in their place. In a way, Brooke, this is fulfilling a campaign promise. But in exchange for that, you're going to have to take on our lies as your lies. People have to decide they're going to either support Trump no matter what he says, or they're going to deal with this really tricky thing of the guy that I supported actually says stuff that's not true. What do I do? That's painful. That's hard.
And that's to group one, the Trump supporters.
Trump supporters. Then there was another message to Trump's dedicated opponents, many of whom turned out in the streets the day after the inauguration, which is simply, go nuts. We're going to continue with the spectacular lies, and there's going to be day after day of stuff for you to hate. The more extreme you get in your reaction and your rhetoric, the better for us. So do it.
Yeah, because you'll just embolden our supporters even more. You'll drive them deeper
totally
into our arms.
Yeah.
Then you've got the group that fall into neither of the previous two camps.
I call them the neither nors.
Right.
They're not Trump's hardcore supporters, but they haven't decided that they're in opposition to him either. Maybe they're in wait and see mode. Maybe they voted, but they're a little bit doubtful. The neither nors. For those people, the message is everybody's shouting again. It's very hard to figure out what's going on. This spectacle is getting uglier. Trying to find out who's really right. The people who say there's no evidence of voter fraud, the people who say, are you kidding? It's obvious. It would take a lot of work to figure that out. So you should just go on and live your life. And for that group of people, the Trump world is raising what economists call search costs, what it takes you to get enough information to make a good decision. And sometimes we make bad decisions or we act irrationally, not because we're irrational creatures, but because the search costs are just so high that we can't figure out what's going on.
But why doesn't the Trump camp, rather than generate this fog machine to further disorient and paralyze the neither-nors, try to attract them?
Lots of the things that Trump wants to do aren't necessarily popular. So if you can surround them with fog and confusion and people don't pay attention as much, you can get a lot more done.
Now, contributing to this fog of confusion and apathy is Kellyanne Conway. You've been ensnared in a controversy about her because of remarks you made to the podcast Recode. The Washington Free Beacon wrote, "A journalism professor is calling for a boycott on White House advisor Kellyanne Conway because of her ability to deflect criticism of the administration." What really happened there, Jay?
I was asked about Kellyanne Conway, how the press should handle her. And I said that I think the journalistic rationale for continuing to interview her had eroded, in that I could see two reasons why you would continue to have her on. One is because she represents the views of Donald Trump. But frequently, what she says is contradicted by Donald Trump. Or she'll say, "I don't know, you'll have to ask him." Well, if we have to ask him, why are we talking to you? Another reason might be to get clarity on how Trump world thinks. But I don't know about you, when I'm done listening to Kellyanne Conway, I feel I know less about what Trump world thinks, in the sense that introducing confusion is a part of her method.
It subtracts from the general store of information about Trump.
Yes. So what I said was, if you're going to continue to interview Kellyanne Conway, the logic has to be somewhat different. One would be entertainment. It is entertaining to watch her fence with Chuck Todd. Another would be, we don't want to get criticism for being one-sided, so we ask Kellyanne Conway on so we can say the Trump world is represented. Avoiding criticism.
But in that case, you have to cop to it.
Yeah, you have to say it.
That we are doing this for pure numerical balance, and
exactly,
we don't expect to get any real information.
Right. Just level with us. Say, this is why we're doing this.
We can't resist.
I know the press is going to continue to interview her.
Which brings us back to the White House press room and something you wrote in one of your posts, send in the interns.
Mm-hmm. You don't have to serve as a hate object. There's nowhere it is written that you must do that.
However, it is written in most intern contracts.
Right. If that's what we ask you to do, then that's what you will do.
There's another reason I love the idea of sending interns, and that's the optics of it. I mean, mm-hmm, the younger, the better.
Yes.
Have Spicer unload his big guns on 18-year-olds and blame them for the collapse of civilization.
Yeah, and maybe they would come up with a different way of fencing with Sean Spicer than the pros do, right?
True.
Maybe they would come up with almost like a Stephen Colbert-ish, you know, misdirection play that would constitute their cultural theater being practiced upon the White House as opposed to the reverse. So that's another
reason.
I love
that. Super ironic people
whatever
in the newsroom. That would be the best. Let's get back to that up for grabs, the neither nors. The silver lining here is that these are people who are not already so subsumed in confirmation bias on either side that they can actually be open to information.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really struck by what you said in one of your posts when you directed us to make a distinction that sociologist C. Wright Mills wrote about in the 1950s between troubles and issues.
Right. Troubles are the things that are actively bothering people in their immediate environment, the problems they can see in their daily lives that they discuss with family members. Issues are public disputes about what to do that are also affected by what the political system needs to mobilize people, create coalitions, avoid criticism. So if journalists just come into the picture after the issues are formulated by somebody else and start reporting on how they get fought about, they're going to miss out on this earlier step where people's troubles get transformed into issues.
It's not political reporting, really, to go out there. It's, as you say, it's troubles reporting.
Yeah.
So that you don't end up just reporting on someone else's definition of someone else's experience.
And that's where I think reporting in 2016 fell down. And that's where I think journalists now have to go back and try the big listen and get a very good read on the troubles that led people to be so disgusted with the establishment and some of them to vote for Donald Trump. To go back and fashion out of that a kind of anchoring reporting agenda, they could begin to speak to that third middle group in a way that the Trump administration or Congress is not prepared to do.
And then you want that to inform all the rest of the reporting, right?
Yes. An example of this is the Texas Tribune. Their bread and butter is policy reporting. You know, they're
and
in,
data.
And data. And they're in the Capitol a lot. They're based in Austin. After the election, they put out a job listing for a reporter whose job is specifically to listen to Texans. That's their whole job. To make sure that the issues talked about in the Texas Tribune don't disconnect from the troubles that Texans feel in their daily lives. So that's one way of doing it, to try and go back to that wrong turn. When, for example, the pundits on the roundtables say, well, how do you think this is going to play with the white working class? That's viewing the white working class through the eyes of the consultants and handlers and pollsters, right? They're objects. They're like balls on the billiard table. Will they break this way or will they break that way? That way of seeing people was corrosive.
Jay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Jay Rosen teaches journalism at New York University and writes about the media on his blog, presslink.org.
As we heard earlier, one of the president's first actions this week was to sign an executive order known as the Mexico City Policy. The order essentially cuts American aid money to international operations that discuss abortion as a family planning option. That's why opponents call it the global gag rule. Reactions were predictable.
It is the targeting of the most vulnerable women in the whole world with a policy that is going to mean women will die because of this action.
It's an issue very important to the pro-life community in helping to stop taxpayer dollars to be involved in the abortion industry abroad.
But this is not a particularly Trumpian development. In the 40-plus years war over reproductive rights, foreign aid has long been a battlefield in which at various times both sides have experienced victory and defeat. And the Mexico City policy, it ain't new.
It's been kicking around, actually, as long as I've been alive, since 1984.
Jennifer Donnelly is a historian who researches the anti-abortion movement.
It's an executive action, so it's an easy promise politicians on either side of the debate can make. So Democratic presidential hopefuls in their campaigns will say, on day one or the first week in office, I will reinstate funding for organizations that talk about abortion in their counseling. Republican candidates can also make that promise and then cut it in the first week of office.
The first executive order came from Reagan. When the Democrats came to power, Clinton toggled it the other way, and then George W. Bush toggled it back, and Obama the other way, and now Trump. A kind of ongoing proxy war wherein the proxies are women abroad.
So here's the interesting thing about the Mexico City policy. Of course, it has a drastic impact on women's lives abroad. But the more complicated story is that the policy itself came out of divisions within the anti-abortion movement that go back to the 1970s. A lot of people tend to think of the anti-abortion movement as this homogenous movement closely associated with the Christian right today. But if you go back to the 1970s, the anti-abortion movement itself is pretty diverse and dynamic. Atheists, agnostics, evangelicals, fundamentalist Christians, Mormons, Muslims, Orthodox Jews, various denominations of Protestant faith, and Roman Catholics all trying to get along to push an anti-abortion agenda. They don't always get along. There's a radical edge that believed a zygote, that's a fertilized egg that's then split, is a person from that moment. And they held a hard line that the law should protect them and that abortion was murder with no exceptions. Not everybody actually agrees with that. You know, they're not so sure if they want birth control to be limited that much.
So why did funding become so symbolic?
Because no matter what approach they have to what's the best way of limiting abortion, everybody could agree, let's get rid of funding absolutely. If the anti-abortion movement's fracturing on other issues, it can always unite by going after funding. And then on top of that, the rhetoric around this strengthens alliances with, especially in the 1970s, Republican politicians. Funding campaigns drew on a rhetoric that painted the government as bad, right? So if the government's funding abortion and it might be coercing women into those abortions, we need to stop the government. And then they also have this humanitarian bent that they're standing up for the least desirable fetuses. Because funding typically would go to women on Medicaid, you know, the marginalized communities. Republican politicians know that going after abortion legislatively can cause divisions in the movement that are not necessarily the best for those Republican politicians when it comes to election time. But if you go after funding, they'll all hold together.
Now, you mentioned Republican politicians. We probably have the notion that this is and has always been a major obsession of the GOP and a rallying point, but not necessarily so. It was after Roe v. Wade, right, that Jesse Helms, the late senator from North Carolina, introduced the Helms Amendment that really opened up abortion to national debate and clarified the division between parties. Tell me about the Helms Amendment.
One of the first things he does to make his mark is to propose a rider on a budget at the last minute, so it flies under the radar, that the United States will not fund any abortions through its foreign aid. So since 1974, when it goes into enforcement, the United States government has not spent any money funding the procedure of abortions. As they gain victories, they're looking more and more for keeping the funding battle so they can keep together. So they gain the victory of the Hyde Amendment in 1976, which takes out abortion funding domestically in the United States. They bring the battle to the states, down to county levels. And even to some extent today, the funding battles are still going and they still unite the movement and keep Republicans who are willing to do that battle with them on funding, keeps that as a close alliance.
Since you're a historian, I guess I should ask you about the domestic pressure President Reagan was under at the time, having named Sandra Day O'Connor to the Supreme Court, a woman who supported women's right to reproductive self-determination.
Yes, and Reagan got a tremendous amount of flack from the anti-abortion movement and the Christian right, to the point that they actually held a huge rally against Reagan when the Sandra Day O'Connor appointment came through. The anti-abortion movement as well, in 1980, the expectation is that they would get major federal legislation through that would curb abortion access. And the anti-abortion movement itself fractured around that legislation. And therefore, by 84, nothing had really been passed at the federal level. So there was a lot of dissatisfaction, both at Ronald Reagan himself and then within the movement on the eve of the Mexico City policy.
Was the Mexico City rule, when it first appeared in 1984, just an attempt to assuage that cohort?
If you want to be cynical, that would be a major component of it. But I don't want to discount the fact that there were people in the Reagan administration who were drafting that, who genuinely held an anti-abortion position and were trying to move to protect fetal life. But if you look at the politics and the actual election, definitely the Mexico City policy appeases members of the Christian right and major organizations come out celebrating it. So the National Right to Life Committee, which is one of the nation's largest anti-abortion organizations, says it's very pleased and it's proving once again that Ronald Reagan is the pro-life president.
And now 33 years later comes Donald Trump, whose political history is such that it was as a supporter for reproductive rights. He's now fancied himself a so-called pro-lifer. Is there more significance to this particular toggle of the Mexico City order than in previous changes of party in the White House?
I will say the one difference in this toggle back and forth is the fact that you had the Women's March on Washington last weekend, millions taking to the street for various reasons, but certainly as one of the platforms of that march, they supported reproductive rights. I do think that for the first time, the strong presence of a pro-choice protest make this toggle look slightly different because the largest anti-abortion protest each year usually happens the same week the policy is announced. And that's the National Right to Life March, which has been going on since 1974.
I don't want to suggest that in any way that these are trivial matters at play here. Obviously, they're not. But the toggle has become so predictable, so perfunctory. Does it have the meaning it had back in 1984? Or is it just sort of a trope of domestic politics, the kind of thing that gets ridiculed on Veep?
And the shame of that is, if you go abroad and look at it from their point of views, this is a policy that's really impacting women's lives abroad and impacting these organizations. Every 4 to 8 years, they're having to completely reorganize as a result of this executive action. So if I have a feeling to potentially roll my eyes, that's what comes into mind and potentially stops it.
Jennifer, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jennifer Donnelly is a historian who researches the anti-abortion movement.
Coming up, the fast life and inglorious death of the phrase fake news.
This is On the Media.
I got my potato.
On Radiolab.
And I'm looking at it and I'm holding it.
We consider the mundane.
It's a handsome shape.
And stop to smell the potatoes.
I've been telling people about my potato. They're always surprised, and I say, you wouldn't understand.
Small potatoes on Radiolab.
It's my friend.
Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. And now a look at the meteoric rise and immolation of the phrase fake news. In the days following the election, the media were adrift, destabilized, craving for some explanation for how they'd gotten so much so wrong. Fake news emerged from the mists.
Tonight, faking news. Political lies spread on social media by unsuspecting users. Did it change the course of the election?
While established media outlets are brands built on accuracy, rogue websites, some masquerading as legitimate, are reporting misinformation, and it's spreading like wildfire online.
Flat-out lies, deemed as the truth. The fake news writer who says he is the reason Donald Trump will be in office, and the guilt he feels about that now.
A seductive narrative for many, and it seemed to have data backing it up.
BuzzFeed News says fake election stories sparked more interest than real ones. BuzzFeed counted comments and shares on Facebook during the last 3 months of the campaign. It found that hoaxes and stories from biased sites far outperformed reports from major news outlets.
All but three of the top 20 fake news stories were anti-Clinton or pro-Trump.
Now, the number one trending article in that time was about Pope Francis endorsing Donald Trump for president. And that wasn't even true.
Finally, it all made sense. Fake news had poisoned the well. And boy, did we want you to know it.
A major crackdown announced today by Facebook. Since the election, the social media giant has come under fire for the spread of fake news on its site.
Last weekend, a fake news story about Clinton led to a shooting in Washington, D.C.
It's now clear that so-called fake news can have real-world consequences. It's a danger that must be addressed.
But maybe it was too catchy. It started as a liberal meme, but then the right ran with it.
Fake news is whatever people living in the liberal bubble determined to be believed by the right. And of course, it's based on a complete hoax.
This is headline from the Washington Post. Russian operation hacked a Vermont utility, showing risk to U.S. electrical grid security, officials say. Of course, if you got to the article now, you'd see a huge correction on top. It turns out the whole thing was fake news, and not the only fake news in that highly fake newspaper.
I think the biggest piece of fake news in this election was that Donald Trump couldn't win.
And then the reductio ad absurdum. Some news is fake. Therefore, all news is fake.
The president-elect angrily denied the claims contained in a dossier, calling it fake news.
It's all fake news. It's phony stuff. It didn't happen.
I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you stay categorical?
You are fake news.
Co-opted in the blink of an eye. Farewell, fake news. And don't let the door hit you on the way out. Because probably the media made too much of it to begin with. Because BuzzFeed released a new study, this time measuring whether people actually trust the news they see online. And it found that even though more than half of people get news from Facebook, just a little over a quarter of them say they actually trust it. So maybe we're not quite as gullible as we'd feared. And another study, carried out by two economists, found that only 15% of people even remembered seeing the fake news they read. And of those who remembered it, only half believed it, a mere 8% of the total. Not only that, but some of them claimed to remember fake news headlines that the study's authors had invented as placebos. Matthew Genskow, who co-authored that study, told us that once you account for the placebo effect, even fewer than 8% believed or even recalled them. Which leaves us where? Was fake news the great moral panic of 2016? Is it still in our midst, summoning its strength, waiting to strike again?
I think we're at the point where, honestly, the term has become almost meaningless.
Craig Silverman is media editor for BuzzFeed.
Today, I used it in a headline, and I kind of felt bad about that, to be honest with you.
Silverman is a longtime fake news researcher and the author of the original study that many used to suggest that fake news might have swung the election. He's also the author of the more recent study that suggests that that's probably overstating the case.
We surveyed about 1,000 American adults, and we asked them two things. One was, where did you get news from in the last 30 days? 55% of people said they had gotten news on Facebook in the last 30 days, and 56% of people said they had gotten news from broadcast TV in the previous 30 days, which is pretty remarkable.
You also asked about trust?
Yeah, so this is where a big gap opened up. For people who had gotten news from broadcast TV in the previous 30 days, 66% of them said that they trusted all or most of the time. And when it came to newspapers, it was even higher. It was 74%. But for Facebook, only 27% of them said that they trusted that information all or most of the time.
A very high degree of skepticism, which is reassuring.
Yeah. But most people in these kinds of surveys rate themselves very good at spotting something that is fake or not fake. We overestimate our ability on that. We always consider ourselves to be very rational beings. And this is especially true for journalists. We think, oh, I'm not going to get fooled. I'm not going to fall for something. But we're all susceptible to this.
Well, then what was the point of your study if you can't believe what people say? That's cold comfort indeed.
Well, you know, that's science. We worked with researchers who do a lot of public opinion polling, and we spent a lot of time trying to craft the questions. But ultimately, you can't control for everything. And so we need a lot more research, and we need the platforms to open up and give more data to more researchers. One of the things that happened with fake news, it became kind of a political football. And so I think we lost some of the genuine conversation around its impact.
So you think that the news media in general have been overstating its power?
It didn't give Trump the election, but it is confusing a certain segment of the population, and it's certainly getting a fair amount of exposure on Facebook. Fake news is really interesting because of what it says about our media ecosystem. What I call fake news is stuff that's 100% fake, usually created for a financial motive. For example, the Pope endorsing Trump hoax originated on a site that was filled with completely fake information run by a guy out of California who had like 40 other sites like that. And he had run literally hundreds of fake news articles over the course of 2016.
He sold ads around them?
It was becoming a pretty good business. And so I think a lot of people flooded into that.
The stuff that worked well on Facebook was the stuff that was more aggressive. It was more shocking. I spoke to somebody who runs a pretty large hyperpartisan conservative site. He's got more than 2 million fans. And he was complaining to me that the kids in Macedonia that were pushing fake news did not launch the sites because they love Trump. They did it because it was a business opportunity. Mm-hmm. And they skewed it. If you wanted to compete, you had to do the misleading stuff. And so I think that's one of the stories of the election, of how, you know, the performance of the fake stuff on Facebook created so much noise, so much misleading and false information, that in the end, people may not have said that they believed the headlines, but I think there were a decent amount of people who were awash in this kind of information. So I wonder if, as people who were already inclined to be pro-Trump shared this stuff, did it polarize them more? Did it get to their edges of their network and other people who maybe hadn't made up their mind started to see this stuff a little bit more? And I don't think it's going to change their mind, but I just wonder if that repetition of it over time starts to have an effect on people.
We have talked a lot over the last decade or so about the disappearance of the public square, a place where people can go and share in the same pool of information. It's been more or less replaced with Facebook, with 100,000 million different little filter bubbles. On the other hand, circling back to why we're having this discussion, your study, about the high degree of skepticism people claim to have about this information compared to television or newspapers, should we be feeling the kind of moral panic that so many of us do, that all this garbage is out there?
The thing that concerns me most, when you start to get that kind of information that is fed to you to go to your emotions, to go to your beliefs, that is sometimes fake, sometimes misleading, it polarizes you more. And then it's almost like eating junk food or eating a lot of sugar. You seek more of that out. And the algorithms are built to give you more of what you want. And when they go and they read something that's got another point of view or that doesn't present it in that same kind of hyperpartisan way, what's their reaction going to be? Are they going to read that and be like, this isn't the news I'm used to? Will people forget what an actual kind of fact-based report that isn't torqued look like? That's the dystopian kind of thing. And we're not there, but you can sort of see how the combination of algorithms and our human biases and the massive reach of platforms and a pretty polarized society and a polarizing administration, that is the thing that I worry about most.
So if the problem isn't, strictly speaking, changing people's minds, but increased polarization, fact-checking isn't going to help that, is it?
Real or fake, we love to see and consume information that aligns with who we are as a person and what we already think and believe. We think, oh, I'm not going to get fooled, but we're all susceptible. So the main thing, I think, is just to realize that there's certain amounts of interacting with information that we control, and there are certain things that we do because of our reptilian core. When I read something that makes me feel good, I try to make myself question why that is. And I think that level of emotional skepticism of your own emotions is maybe the next level for people to try and get to. The other piece of it is when you see bad information out there and it's coming from somebody you know and somebody you trust, rather than leaving them a comment on Facebook, try to talk to them on the phone and try to understand. Because if we're worried about polarization, actually being able to talk to people is probably a good defense against that.
Margaret Sullivan, who used to be the New York Times public editor and now writes a media column for the Washington Post, quotes George Washington University professor Nikki Usher, saying that the speed with which the term fake news became polarized, and in fact a rhetorical weapon, illustrates how efficient the conservative media machine has become. And so Sullivan goes on to write, "Here's a modest proposal for the truth-based community. Let's get out the hook and pull that baby off the stage. Yes, simply stop using it. Instead, call a lie a lie, call a hoax a hoax, call a conspiracy theory by its rightful name. After all, fake news is an imprecise expression to begin with."
I'm sort of on board with that, I have to say. I feel like it's lost a lot of its meaning and its nuance. I've genuinely had a couple of conversations with my editors that maybe we should be talking about hoaxes and propaganda and conspiracy theories. One, because these are long-known terms, and maybe people actually understand the distinctions between them better. I mean, to me, fake news will always be stuff that's 100% false, created for financial motive. But that definition has been lost, I think.
Okay. Craig,
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Craig Silverman is the media editor for BuzzFeed. When a news outlet gets something wrong, owns up to it, and apologizes, that's a mistake, not fake news. To call the institution of American journalism fake, based on the errors it will inevitably make, is a by now familiar ploy of the new administration. Cognitive linguist George Lakoff told us it's a tactic known as the salient exemplar. Don't fall for it. As a nation, we stand up for freedom of speech, but there are no slogans proclaiming, no watchdogs protecting your right to actually listen. That's an intensely personal choice, not a political act, until now.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Michael Loewinger, Sara Kari, Leia Feder, and Kate Bakhtiarova. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Terrence Bernardo.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter's WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.